The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
We're going to talk about Rittenbach's paintings a little later. I just wanted to start out by asking him about his recent trip to Senegal. I found out that he returned recently from Dakar, Senegal, and there he has a position with the Gore Institute. Would you like to talk a little bit about that organization?
Okay. Yes, in fact, I just returned the day before yesterday. I tried to get there, if it's possible, a few times during my annual stay in New York, which is from September to December. When I'm not here, that's where I'm based, on the island of Gore, which is the old slave island in the Bay of Dakar. And in 1992, we founded an institute called the Gore Institute on the island. Gore Institute is a Pan-African institute for the promotion of democracy, development, and culture in Africa. It grew out of a rather historic meeting that took place in 1987 when, together with a number of other people, friends, and organizations, I was involved in helping to organize the first major encounter between people who were then in opposing camps in the South African struggle. On the one hand, the African National Congress, the liberation movement at that time in exile, and about 60 people from inside South Africa who were influential community leaders in politics or business or the world of arts, etc. And from there came, from that meeting, very intense encounter, which was illegal, of course, at the time, grew what then became the negotiating process that led to the establishment of the new South Africa in the early 1990s. But beyond that, we sensed that it was important to have an institute that would be, that would have grown as this one did from civil society. In other words, it is not subject to any government or any ideology or any group of governments. It really does, with great difficulty sometimes, work very much from within civil society. We work obviously in the network of other organizations all over the continent and to some extent abroad. The activities take the form of some research, some analysis, a lot of mediation, facilitation, and then together with other organizations trying to implant a number of projects. Just very briefly, for instance, we've been involved in mediating or trying to prevent conflict in Guinea-Conakry, in Guinea-Bissau, in the Ivory Coast. We have a rather wonderful project, which has now become a program called Alliance for Peace Building in the Sub-region. We use the institute and its facilities as an ongoing exhibition space. We have creative writing and creative filmmaking and creative music and workshops on painting. We have a print studio on the island. So it is also exploring, among other things, the very deep interaction, we believe, and the mutual nourishment or reciprocal nourishment between what you could call politics, development, and cultural expressions in the region and in Africa in general.
Okay. That was a very... I don't know how many of you are aware of Rittenbach's political activism, but it goes back very early on in his career as an artist. And I wanted to mention also that I did mention earlier that he teaches creative writing at New York University, and you just come from a class from there. Yeah. So he's all over the place, a truly transnational figure.
Yeah, well, running to keep ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a little bit, all of these various activities may seem to be a kind of a full blossoming of schizophrenia. But I believe that there are a number of bridges or links that inform them. And for me, the most important one is, of course, obviously, the processes of creation or creativity. I think that to engage with a social and economic and political environment in the hope of trying to help or to be participating in attempts to transform some of the givens of that particular society is in itself a creative activity. Obviously, my involvement with painting and with writing has always been very much that. Now, the creativity, I think one can break down to some extent. I often talk about it with my students. You know, what is it that one is doing when you're writing? Or painting, for that matter, although it's not quite the same. But I would say when it comes to writing, if I had to whittle it down to a few very essential concerns, it'll probably be that one is writing oneself and you're rewriting the world.
Say that again?
One is writing oneself, the self,
yes,
and you're rewriting the world.
Okay.
And by that I mean simply that I think the processes of creativity is also a process of awareness growing. It's extending consciousness. And in the process of doing that, I think you start asking questions about notions of identity, notions of memory, notions of origin, notions of diversity, notions of responsibility. All of these and many more, I think what we in Buddhism would call are so many different skandhas or components that people think of as your identity. That's what comes across as your identity. The rewriting of the world part, I think, is that one is engaging with what is out there and probably in the act of trying to recognize it, also trying to transform it to some extent. We do know, I think, that seeing is an act of imagination and it's probably also an act of transformation. The translation of that which one sees and you try to then render either in writing or in painting is very much one, partly perhaps also in a kind of an opportunistic or optimistic way of trying to make it different from what it is. We know the world we live in is not a very pleasant place very often. But I think there is that need which we all share as human beings to imagine ourselves, to invent ourselves, and to invent a world in which we live. That doesn't mean that it is unrealistic, mm-hmm. but I think there is this constant attempt to try and understand it and make it different.
Well, I want to go back. There are a couple of questions that come to mind. One surrounding the issue of identity that you mentioned and transformation. I know transformation is an issue of modernity and a lot of concerns that are taking place in various African nations, the need to transform, the need to move from where they are in a post-colonial state to one of modernity in terms of the arts, culture, economics, and the entire political sphere. So that was a very important point, I think, that you brought up. But identity in terms of the arts, I think in terms of discussing postmodernism, that identity has played a dominant role for many groups and many people from various cultural groups and various people within in the West have all been dealing with issues of identity in the last 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that whole phenomena and how does that relate to your work?
Well, I think that I come originally from a part of the world, as you mentioned, because I was born in South Africa, grew up there, and in some way remain linked to it, although not very intimately so, at least not to the extent that I feel that I participate in what is happening there, and a lot is happening there, even, you know, as one says, as we speak. Of course, one of the drawbacks of being a nomad is that you do not have the privilege of perhaps engaging as deeply as you would like to with what is happening on the ground and with new realities appearing. But in that country, the notion of identity was a very painful question. Mm-hmm. The oppression that had been installed over many centuries and was reaching its apotheosis in the second part of the 20th century was very much posited on the notion of identity, the notion of difference, the notion, not only difference, but notions of hierarchical difference. Mm-hmm. You know, so-and-so is better than so-and-so, and you're born better than so-and-so because of the color of your skin or because of your gender or because of the language you speak or perhaps even the region that you came from. So the problematic of identity, the problematic of trying to understand it and what it is linked to, like language, for instance, to religion, to obviously to ideology, to social forms, I think it was extremely important to do that. Now, for those of us, and it turned out to be the majority, obviously, who were involved in trying to supersede this abuse of identity, the question arose then, what do you replace it by? Can one conceive of, can one project an identity that more people can identify with? In other words, can you transform? That was what was really meant by the notion that Mandela came to symbolize of building a new nation. I used to say in the old days that the liberation movement, which really did represent the majority of South Africans, was a vehicle for replacing the various smaller identities with the one of a South African identity. It didn't quite turn out to be that. Or rather, it's very much an unfinished process. But what I also learned in the process of doing that is you never really do away entirely with the local, with that which is linked to your own memories of childhood, to the place you grew up in, to your own language, perhaps to your religious practices. But the fascinating thing in Africa more and more, and I'm sure this is something that's very much true in this country as well, is I think part of modernity is how do we conceive of and how do we handle this dialectic between specificity on the one hand, which may be regional, which may be cultural, which may be linguistic, and the shared values that may be embodied in shared ideals or a shared nation or whatever the case is. I think there is and backwards and forwards all the time between that. There are things we have in common and which we commit to communally and which we are proud of and which we try to develop. Democracy would be one. Right. Justice would be another. Equality, anti-racism, equity, etc., etc., dignity, human dignity, the recognition of human dignity. But on the other hand, and I'm not suggesting that the local or the specific does not also have that, but it expresses it differently. I think it's in the rubbing up of the two against one another that there's real progress. I think, in other words, it is in the conscious interaction and changes that go back and forth between where you start from and who you are when you're at home, as it were, and what you are as a public person or in a larger context, and how these two shape one another. It's within that that I think a certain number of forms of consciousness are refined. And that very much for me is modernity. And that's really what in Africa in many ways we are working towards. But it's a very, very, very complicated process with a lot of regressions and a lot of resistance and a lot of obstacles. I mean, to name only one, it still is a major, major problem to have gender equality in Africa, in most parts of Africa. We still have not broken away from the nearly frozen attitude of the elites hogging all power and the people only being used to legitimate the power that they have, for instance. And there are any number of things. We, in fact, have probably a backward move now. There's a re-traditionalization of the continent in many parts. We'll come to that. Yeah. There are reasons for that, by the way.
Yes.
And one of the reasons is because the West has not lived up to what it's promised to do.
And also, I think there are things that are ensconced in traditional cultures that need to be reexamined and looked at in terms of how it can be applied to contemporary living.
Yeah.
You know, I think it has a place in modernity. It was interesting to hear you talk about some of the issues that South Africa had to confront in its move towards a democracy. I think that there are parallels from what I've been able to gather and what I've heard from artists and from various people living in South Africa. There are parallels and challenges that are similar to those that we experience in this country, especially when it comes to race relations.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think probably not exactly the same equation, perhaps not exactly the same process, but there are some certain number of core givens which are exactly the same. And in fact, I think there was a lot of inspiration that went backwards and forwards. I remember that many people in South Africa were very influenced and very inspired by the civil rights movement. I know that in this country, of course, there was a lot of support for the struggle for liberation and for independence and for justice in that country. So there's a lot. There are specificities, important ones. I'm not quite sure that one could say, for instance, that South Africa has ever really been a melting pot. Mm-hmm. Probably what we will come up with, if we do get there, will be something different. And, of course, also, in the case of South Africa, one had a case of a minority of European origin repressing a very, very vast majority of people, the majority of whom had never been enslaved. You know, this is an important difference, too. We do have an important component of the South African society who are descendants of slavery and of mixing that came out of that cauldron, as it were. And these are the so-called colored people in South Africa. Yeah. But the what we call the African people in South Africa, we're skewered on very odd kinds of terminology, which also keeps on moving all the time. Mm-hmm. Thank heavens, you know, we can move beyond this kind of iron caste categorization of one another in terminology. But the very vast majority of the people, 73% of the South African population, are indigenous people who've never been, they've been colonized, yes,
right,
and to some extent vanquished in separate wars or successive wars.
Similar to the Native Americans here in this
exactly,
country.
Exactly. So that gives another kind of a take on what's coming out of it now.
What I know we seem to be dealing a lot on the broader cultural issues rather than the specifics about
okay.
your work. But we'll get to that. But I just wanted to give the audience a little bit of background of where you started in terms of your orientation as a political activist. And you started that early on in your career when you decided to become an artist.
Yeah. Well, of
did
course,
that happen simultaneously?
Yeah, well,
were you how did it all unfold? Did you was your awareness heightened by going to an art school?
Yeah,
did that sort
yeah.
of was that
definitely.
An awakening?
Definitely. You must remember I'm partly a child of the 60s, well, even a little bit earlier, of the late 50s. I wanted to be a painter. I was lucky enough to get the bursary to go to university, but not to go and study painting. If I had done what I was supposed to be doing, I would have gone to another university where there was no art school attached, and I don't know what I would have become, but I really did want to become a painter. I really wanted to learn that. I went to University of Cape Town at that time. This is now the very late 50s. It was part of only 5 universities in the country that were still integrated, even if only nominally so. Mm-hmm. And in fact, during my time there, the government of the day was then pushing through the final segregation of these universities. In other words, they were taking out the Indian, the colored, and the black students from the universities who were supposed to be going to special universities made for them. And of course, as students, we protested against that. That was my first activism.
Okay.
Very, very first. So I was literally involved in demonstrations and in protest actions with my school, with my schoolmates who were fellow South Africans who were now no longer to be in the same class. And that, the one thing led to the other. And then, of course, it's important, I think, also to not remember or not forget that when one goes into the 60s, then there is a very close correlation between let's say, social activist awareness and artistic, I mean, protest songs, the writing that comes out of that, the painting that goes, for instance, to support the movement against the war in Vietnam, the anti-colonial movement, the anti-racist movements, all of these had their cultural creative components or protagonists. Mm-hmm. And of course, as a young person, that was definitely it. I believed, perhaps naively now when you look back at it, but I'm not quite sure about that. Mm-hmm. I'm not clever enough to be totally disabused. I think it's still possible to believe in many things, but many things have happened in the meantime.
Yes.
And there have been many deceptions. But I believed then that, yes, these are very closely linked activities.
So painting was dominant in your world as an artist, in contrast to writing. When did writing come into the forefront?
Writing started quite early, but I never thought of myself as a professional writer. Mm-hmm. I still don't think, I'm sure, but I do it now, although there's a kind of recognition and I've been able to generate some activities to survive as a writer or writer-related activities like teaching. Mm-hmm. But I don't think one could call oneself a poet and think that that is a career. You know? I think it's obviously it's a vocation and obviously it's a way of life. But I notice there are some people here who make a living from writing poetry. I can't see it happening. But yes, so poetry, I started writing probably the same time I started seriously painting. There comes an interesting thing, an interesting little quirk, and it's related again to the South African history. My native language, my mother tongue, is Afrikaans, which is also the tongue, the language of the people who are in power.
Right.
So that immediately writing with the kind of sensibility that one had, that I had at that time, you were inevitably subversive. And there again, you know, it doesn't matter how hard one struggled, you could write what you thought was a beautiful love poem and something slipped in there that angered the masters, some reference somewhere, and one found oneself political, even if the intent was not necessarily political.
Okay. Because you have been credited to have given flight to the Afrikaan language and served as its liberator in terms of contemporary verse.
I think that's a very wonderful accolade which is totally unjustified. there's one thing that I'm very happy with, and I think and for that I take little part of responsibility of highlighting that, not creating it, but highlighting it. And that is the fact that the Afrikaans language is an indigenous Creole language that was born in the mouths of people who were not of European origin, but who had to communicate among themselves as slaves from very different origins, different countries, different parts of the world. And, of course, with a master who is Dutch-speaking. Mm-hmm. So that you have the crucible within which the language was born was Dutch dialects of the 17th century, but taken over and transformed. And hence, again, we're back with metamorphosis.
Right.
That's why it's so important for me. Transformed and making of it a Creole language, which has all the characteristics of Creole languages, when you think of Pidgin, when you think of Creole as is spoken in the Caribbean, etc., etc. So it was then kidnapped and hijacked by the masters in terms of their identity to separate themselves from the others, including from the English-speaking others, mm-hmm. and became a political tool. What happened also during this struggle for dignity in the country was finally Afrikaans could be liberated from this abusive monopolization or appropriation by people who try to imagine or try to project it as a sign of whiteness, as a sign of European origin. Mm-hmm. And it was always the possession or essentially the making of the people of the country itself. And,
I see.
And in that sense, yes, I participate. Yeah.
Well, I'm just curious. I'm not familiar with the African language, but in my readings about your work, they talk very much about how eloquent you are in that language. And I wanted to know which language lends itself more closely to your intended sound and cadence of your words.
It is probably Afrikaans. I think even behind the English and the French, there is obviously the Afrikaans, and that's partly because of the sound and the suppleness of the language and the very, very vivid imagery and the texture of it, which I think you find in other Creole languages also, but partly also because the place that you grew up in was then very heavily influenced by religious cadences. Mm-hmm. You know, think Dylan Thomas in a kind of a similar,
yes,
in a kind of a similar example.
Okay, that's a good example.
Or for that matter, Baldwin.
Yes, James Baldwin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
One becomes a preacher whether you want to or not.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
We're going to take a look at some of Brittenbach's paintings at this point. We will go back to the literature, and then I will take questions from the audience. I'm sure you have many that are burning on your chest right now. We've touched on a lot of different subjects, and I'm sure you're interested to learn more. But I think I've lost my notes. I don't know what happened to them on the images. You can pick up All My Horse, which is a republication of a book that he wrote in 1989. And there are 27 images reprinted in the book, of which we have four here. And they coincide with the fables or visions that he has written, one building up on the other. There's a loose relationship with all the pieces that are included in this collection. And this piece that's on the presentation on the screen now is related to the piece called Too Late Now. Do you want to talk a little bit about that work?
Mm. Yes, that's the one or two works in that book that actually also came to exist over and beyond the book. This is one example. In Holland, in Rotterdam, there's an annual poetry festival, and for a number of years, they gave every year a prize to somebody who's in prison, and I was asked one year if I would want to do a mural in the city of Rotterdam that would be related to the prize being given to poets or other writers who are in prison or otherwise having a difficult time in the country. So and this is actually, it is a watercolor. From that watercolor, a mural was made that is still on a wall in Rotterdam. And obviously the imagery, I think, speaks for itself. It is, I try not to ascribe symbolic meaning to images, although I'm aware that people will see, depending on who they are, because there, I think, also there's a bit of cultural conditioning. The one symbol or image may not trigger off the same things in different cultures. But I suppose there are some motifs already there that have been accompanying me for quite a while. The bird, the horse, the man, in this case, looking out to the bars. There's no literal intention. There's a kind of, I believe that a painting, when it happens, as to some extent a poem also, has its own intelligence and has its own clarity, but it's not necessarily the intelligence or the clarity that is transferable to what we talk about in everyday life. Mm-hmm. It's not illustrative. I think if it works, it brings with it its own little parable or its own narrative, but that has to be understood within its own contents.
As I was reading your work, I noticed that there were symbols such as the bird that you use repeatedly in your literature and your writing, your poem and your prose, and the eye seeing inward, the eye seeing outward. And I just wanted to know briefly, maybe looking at this particular piece, what do these symbols mean to you on a very personal level? What are your interpretations of them? The mouth and the lips are also a reference that you use often, especially in your early collections of poems.
Well, before that, just one. This is interesting in that, as you can see, it's somebody painting a cell portrait. That little text I read from the book, it was not actually going with this one, but it is a theme that runs through the book, the notion of an other that is the self, the twin. Or I remember doing a show in South Africa many years ago called Self Portraits and Other Ancestors, and trying to suggest that whatever one paints becomes a self-portrait, because it's you painting it, and probably as much a kind of an exteriorization or the embodiment of the way you see the world, and therefore it is a self-portrait. The eyes, the mutilation, rather, that often happens, I think for me it is related to awareness, to consciousness, to seeing, and to impediments to seeing, or to being wounded in seeing sometimes.
Because you, in one of your poems, you talk about the eye looking inside the mind, and the eye sort of shaping the skull. So it's an inward sort of journey that you're taking in the process of seeing. And seeing through the spoken word, may I be so bold as to interpret that with the mouth and the eye being shown through the lips.
Well, I'm always intrigued to see. Often, I think, it needs somebody like you to see, to tell me what it is I've been doing.
I
mean that in a real sense.
Yeah, I think that what happens very often is paintings take on a life force of their own. You put them out in the world, and people bring to them their experiences and their interpretations, and you add that to your repertoire of what your vision or how your vision has been expanded to exist in the broader world.
But I would, you know, a little word of warning, which I'm sure you are very aware of, because obviously you know much more about these things and much more deeply. No, I mean it, is that, of course, very often things take on meaning when they were not necessarily intended, at least not in quite the same way. I'm thinking of sort of like a Picasso-like thought there, that, for instance, one... within a painting, on a surface, a certain conversation takes place, and it has to do with colors, and it has to do with shapes, and it has to do with repetition. So the one calls forth the other to some extent. In this one particularly, for instance, obviously I needed something happening at the top of the painting. If I had been an abstract painter, it may have been just a shape or a marker or something.
Yes.
In this case, the mouth of the person, I don't know at what point the top part happened and how it, of course one can read it like from the top mouth down to the mouth of the painter doing, by the way, I had in mind a painter, I can't remember his name now. I always try to steal other people's identities. And of course he's painting, but it also has his brush in the mouth of the there you have a very direct, if you want to see it that way, what you were saying, that the mouth is also the form of expression,
right,
of carrying the word. So So, but it, the one at the top then turned out to be a mouth, not really so much, or an eye for that matter. It's not a mouth, I'm sorry, it's an eye. It was really the shape that needed to come about. And I'm not sure whether one should read much more. The tear that you will find in many of the stories in the book, it recurs in many of the images. Yeah. And I'm not quite sure. Well, I'm not quite sure. I'm not sure that it means anything. But I certainly have clear memories of how it came about. I'm going to refer to a painter, I'm not sure people here know, but a man called Marian. He was a Polish painter who died in the 1980s. He was well known in Europe. He'd been in the death camps. He'd lost a leg or both legs. I can't remember. I never met him. And I remember being very impressed with a series of paintings he made. We exhibited in the same gallery in Holland, which were clowns. He painted, obsessively painted clowns, which of course I'm as much of a looker as I am as a painter. So I also project meanings or memories on those things or possible allusions. And one could say that he may have been saying, you know, the world is just one big circus. But what struck me at the time that these clowns were weeping copiously. Not in a kind of a sentimental or even pathetic way of, as one would think of a Van Gogh painting, where somebody would be sort of, you know, with hunched shoulders, sitting forward, with holding his head in his hands, weeping, but a kind of an explosion of tears. And that's perhaps where the tears came from me to start with.
Okay.
And then, of course, it became integrated.
And then it also reminds me of Van Gogh's self-portrait with the amputated ear.
Sure.
And the wounding of a part of the body, a particular part of the head.
Yeah.
But so at this point, I think Andy is a little anxious for me to move on. We'll have questions from the audience.
I see a hand over there.
Now you see a hand? Yes. Yeah. Oh, please wait for the microphone.
I do want to thank you for coming today. I have read your work for the past 30 years, back from when I was in college in Africa. As a college professor, I've been using your text, The True Confessions of the Albino Terrorist. And I wanted you to give me a context now so I can tell my students tomorrow what was the circumstances that led to you writing that book, and the very highly regarded book in my university. That's question number one. The question number two has to do with Gorée Island. To what extent have you, with your power and energy and world acclaim, attempted to make sacred what Gorée Island represents to the African experience? It can be compared to the situation in Auschwitz or Treblinka.
Maybe I'll have to ask you to repeat the second one again, but let me talk about the first one. The True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist was a book that tries to relate as comprehensively as possible the actual prison experience between 1975 and 1982. I was not allowed to write in prison, at least not that kind of stuff, obviously. After the second trial, I'm not going to go into all of that because unfortunately it is a long story, but I've been sentenced the first time, tried to continue smuggling out little bits of writing, obviously. The security police were probably aware of it and probably complicit in allowing these things to be smuggled out because they hoped that I would be identifying people with whom I had been active with before. They were hoping to catch other people, obviously. It so happened it was mostly just poems, etc. But in any case, there was a second trial, and during that trial there was a lot came to light about the conditions that I was actually kept, which is isolation. And pressure was brought to bear internationally and from fellow writers and others. Allow this man to write at least, you know. He's he will go mad, and probably he'll be less harmful if you would just let him write. So they allowed me to write. I wrote. They gave me a paper every day, which was numbered, and it was taken back in the evening. And from that writing came a number of poems, and came a book called Mouroir, which is written in prison. But the moment I came out, one of the things that I found, and I'm sure this is true of many other people who've been through similar experiences, you've been cut off from the world for so long that when you come out, you just talk all the time. You want people to know. You want to tell people. And I remember my wife telling me at a point, saying, just sit down and write it, because otherwise you will never stop talking. It was an act of public hygiene to get me to sit down and to write. I remember it was very soon after my release. We were lucky to be given the use of a little apartment in Palermo in Italy, and I sat down. I also needed to tell her the story, what it had been like in prison. So the book says this at some point, I think in a note towards the end. The way of writing this was actually not writing. I sat down every night with a tape recorder and recounted a part of what I could, well, as fully as I could, the memory of what actually happened. I tried to organize in my mind according to subject matter, the visitors one had, how one was moved from one prison to the other, et cetera, et cetera. And then these I would leave, and my wife the next day would transcribe the tape, type it out, and it was, in a sense, my way of telling her my story. She would then give me back the transcription, and I worked on that as a second version, or as a second writing, as it were. And that's how the book came about. And it's been out there.
Wouldn't you say it was a way of remembering and ordering your world and your mind from a period where you were in isolation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is very much that. It's a hybrid book in many ways, because it was that, definitely. There was a kind of the line running through was a chronological one of trying to explain or to tell, how did I get to be there? What happened? How does one get into prison? How you become a prisoner? Because the purpose of prison is to make of you a prisoner. Mm-hmm. It's nothing else. It's not to rehabilitate you. It's not to change you. And the effect of that is you become a prisoner. You become what we call in South African prison language institutionalized. Mm-hmm. Anybody kept there for long enough becomes essentially a prisoner. Your whole world is reduced to that. What does that mean? What are the customs of being a prisoner? What's the history? What's the language that's being used? What are the relations with other prisoners? It is a total universe within itself. And that it was trying to describe all of that. In other words, there's a lot about fellow prisoners and about the conditions. In the process of doing that is also a reflection on the politics of prison. Because in South Africa it was said that there were not all that many political prisoners, but in fact we had tens of thousands of prisoners who were supposedly common law prisoners, who in fact were there because their passes were not in order, or they were in a particular place after curfew, or any number of laws that were broken, that were laws that were the expression of political conditions, and people were criminalized for very human infractions of just wanting to be living as a full human being. So there's a reflection on that. There's a reflection also on the purposes and the pitfalls of political activism. But there's another layer to the book, and that is a reflection on the act of writing and the place in which it was written. Because I felt that, for instance, I kept on having recurring dreams and nightmares. Those also went into the book. That was, of course, post-prison, but they were conditioned very much still by that. So it's also a description of, as it were, the coming down from the experience that I had, being reinserted into the normal world, mm-hmm. The decompression, like when you come back from outer space, that little in-between part, yeah. Where you are being decompressed, yeah. So you don't explode when you come out.
Yeah.
That was that. I'm sorry, so the second question.
The second part to your question?
I didn't quite.
The second question had to do with Gorée Island that I'd visited. Oh. I've visited there many times, and I was wondering, you talked about that, and I was wondering what, I'm interested in the deification, if you can use that term, or making sacred that particular part of the world in Africa, because that's essentially where the warehousing of Africans were packed together before they had to go through the land of no return. And so my question is, what effort are you and others putting forward to make sacred that particular land as is with other individuals, groups who have suffered such inhumanity of man towards other men?
Did you get that?
I think he's talking about the history of Gorée Island.
Oh, yes.
Was at one point to be earmarked as a sacred ground.
Yes.
And that it documents a horrendous juncture in the history.
Yes. Gorée Island is not the most important slave warehouse on the west coast of Africa. There are others a little bit further down along the African coast, particularly on the Gold Coast, Ghana, and all that, that were far more horrendous in the numbers of people that went through there. But Gorée Island is, in a sense, a kind of a crucible, a kind of a concentration of what happened over centuries, the slave trade. It's a very intricate history. For instance, one part of the history of Gorée Island is that it had been successively occupied by the Portuguese, by the French, by the Dutch, the English for a little while, and it changed hands many times because obviously they saw the importance of possessing that island. It is offshore. It's within striking distance. It's only 4 miles from the coast. The word itself, Gorée, is a contraction of the Dutch goede reede, meaning good anchorage. It is a safe place to anchor. There are not very strong winds, there are not strong currents, etc. It's a small island that the people that they built their houses on, the colonizers, they were not colonizing. In the first instance, it was not a colonizing project. It was a project of establishing a presence as a slave-buying entity. And, of course, then from there they went inland and they created the colony that became a French Sudan eventually, running all the way up to the Sudan border, Mali, Senegal, Mauritania, etc. We don't quite know how many people came through there. The large majority of slaves that were on the island were probably more domestic slaves than they were export slaves. It's horrible to talk of people in those terms. Mm-hmm. But yes, one knows that people were captured on the mainland or bought on the mainland. And that, of course, is again a very long and a complicated and intricate history. How did these people come to be bought? How did they came to be available to be bought? Who captured them? Why were they captives? Why were they traded, either in raids or in just straightforward buying processes? They were then brought to the island. They were kept on the island. The whole of the island was one huge slave holding place. In fact, if you go to the island now, nearly all of the ground floors, the cellars, you can still see traces that this is where slaves were kept. And then they were exported from there to the so-called New World. Now, two things I want to mention quickly because it's a very complicated and long and a very rich history, or three things. One is there were periodic slave uprisings on the island. The guardian angel, if I may call it that in Western terms, the deity in local belief is Kumba Castell. She's a woman, and it's claimed that you can sort of see her at night walking through the little alleys of the island, and it's not sure whether if you see her, if you meet her, it's a good sign or a bad sign. But it's apparently she was a historic character, a woman who led slave uprising. There were many slave uprisings. The second remark is that from the cohabitation between slaves and slave owners or slave traders and other administrators, there emerged a whole caste of people called the signars. The signar people were, it's a maternal society, a matriarchal society. Essentially, these were women who became the wives, and they were to some extent married according to local custom. There were actually ceremonies of these European traders, and when these European traders left, or when the administrators left, the women were endowed. They were better off than the other slaves anyway, because they were the wives or the concubines of the masters. Their children would be of mixed descent, and they were endowed, so they became quite rich compared to others, and they themselves became very rich slave owners. That's why I said the island was very much a slaving entity of people who lived on the island and were the slaves of other people living on the island. And the signars became very, very rich and very rich slave owners. The houses on Gori, the old so-called traditional Gori families, are houses that belonged, they're very beautiful houses, they're now in disrepair, that belong to big signar families. In fact, the actual slave house belonged to a woman called Anne Pepi, who is a senior woman. When you go to the island now, when you have ceremonies, beautiful women come out dressed up as signars, because they dress slightly different. They had far more jewels. Mm. They wore satin, silk, as opposed to cotton, etc. And I suppose, I don't know, the last thought that I would have, which I do think is important, it is sacred territory. It is very much neglected sacred territory. I've never understood why the diaspora has not been able to see the importance of this and to translate the importance of this. For instance, there is no museum on the island, not really. The slave house is a very pitiful and a very underfinanced entity. I mean, if you compare that to Yad Vashem, which is the equivalent, say, in Jerusalem, of the history of the Jewish people, this is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. We don't have chairs of the study of slavery, for instance, in Dakar. We have IFAN, which is a research institute, and you can get a lot of documentation. It's great stuff that could be actualized, could be used, could be published. We don't have a coherent, good history book on the history of Gori. There are bits and pieces written by Catholic priests and by a few other researchers, but it is not really. But it is there. It is somehow embedded in the presence and in the very air and the foundation of the island. What's important for us at the institute? We're not an institute that can be considered the guardians of the history of Gori. We are, though, very much aware of what this island is, what it stands for, so with the people who live there and the people who are still living there, to transform that into a beacon of hope, to start from the island as an offshore base, as it were, to reactivate, to infuse hope in the sense that people can take hold of their own destinies and they can transform even a history which is as painful as that of slavery, and make of that something that could be used or that could be transformed into giving people an urge for dignity, for self-sufficiency, for development, for promoting processes of democracy, etc., of creation. So we see that very much as taking a history which is profoundly soaked in pain and in suffering, mm-hmm. and using that as so much inspiration. Never again. How do we look after ourselves? How do we pick up from what we are, the scatteredness of what we are, and we build something new on that?
Okay, thank you. Yes, one, two, and I think that's what we have. You can join us upstairs to speak to Brittenbach during his signing.
This is not a question. I'm wondering whether it might be possible for you to speak one of your poems in your native tongue, Afrikaans.
I would love to do that, except I didn't imagine that it would come up, so I don't have a text with me, and I've got the worst memory in the world, unfortunately.
Okay. You're off the hook.
As misschien kan ik net een paar woorden in Afrikaans zeggen, net zodat je idee kan krijgen van hoe klinkt het. Die jaar wordt oud in gouden akkerblaren. That's the first line of a poem of somebody else, much better poet than I am. I don't know, you know, there are any number of little ditties and words and expressions I could use in Afrikaans to give you a sense, but unfortunately I don't.
Do you write them first in that language? Do you first write them in that language?
Yes, my poetry always comes first in Afrikaans. I think the notion of mother tongue literally means mother tongue. I think it literally means that which you learn before you learn words. In other words, the intimate relationship for me in poetry is with sounds and rhythms and textures of language even before they have a verbal meaning.
Okay, we have one gentleman over here, and that's it. Hold your questions. I'm sure Britton will be happy to discuss what you have to entertain your questions upstairs at the book signing. Is that okay? Great. So we have one more person, gentleman here in the center. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Britton, Brittenbach. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I tend to also digress.
Well, you know what?
My whole life has been a digression.
Most people's lives are digressions. I'll tell you what, we're going to...
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.